Manischewitz wine. That's the first product which you could say crosses over from the kosher world into the non-kosher world.
Serendipitously, or was it specifically targeted beyond
It's
those
a total
who keep
surprise.
Kosher?
The owners, they are making, you know, Manischewitz. We all know Manischewitz, a sweet wine for Passover. And it starts to sell in the 40s for Christmas, for Easter, and for Thanksgiving.
It's not just for breakfast anymore.
No. And they're trying to figure out what's going on. Turns out African Americans who moved to the North during World War II start buying Manischewitz. New York City, Detroit, Los Angeles, Boston. It becomes a wine that by the mid-50s is predominantly African-American in its consumer base. Complete surprise.
Now let's talk to the teetotalers, Coke.
Coca-Cola, 1930s, lots of Jews are drinking Coca-Cola. And a pattern develops of Jews letting their children drink it as part of the Passover Seder. I had that experience. I don't know if other people did. Instead of having wine, you had Coke.
It was considered a treat.
It was a treat, absolutely. But was it kosher? So rabbis start to look into this issue, and the major person in that process is a man named Rabbi Tobias Geffen, Atlanta rabbi, and that's where Coke made. And in the tradition of Judaism and Jewish law, you go to the rabbi in the place where the product is being made. Geffen looks into it, and he goes, sorry, it's not kosher.
Why?
It has this ingredient in it called glycerin. Now, glycerin is something that no one ever worries about because it's fine. It's in everything. Glycerin is a product, however, that comes from animal fats. And it ends up in a lot of drinks because it helps flavor diffuse evenly through the liquid. And there's a little bit of pork fat in it. So Geffen looks into this and he says, can't have it. Doesn't matter how small an amount is, you can't have a non-kosher ingredient in a product if it's kosher. So he goes to Coke. Coke goes to their supplier, Procter & Gamble, and they find a way to make glycerin that comes from vegetable sources. And with that, Geffen's able to get Coke to change the recipe. And that allows Coke to become kosher.
Now, is there an overarching board that makes these determinations, or is it done by discourse, argument, conversation, akin to what many describe as the Jewish experience?
Well, of course, there's lots of argument. You know, the old saying is you put two Jews in the room, you have three opinions. But what happens in the course of the, you know, mid to late 20th century is this kind of argumentation becomes organized. At first, it's really sort of chaos. Some rabbis say this, some rabbis say that. There's no Supreme Court, so who says it's kosher? But by the 1970s, 1980s, it's kind of gotten smaller. You've got some certification organizations like the Orthodox Union, like OK Kosher Certification. There's a few big figures in them who everybody respects. And so folks look to these organizations to work things out. So you still have disagreements, but it's not chaos. It's organized debate. And sometimes you have some real differences between those organizations over what they will accept and what they will not.
This book is in large measure a personal account. And let's note that this was written during a very tough time in your life.
Well, it starts because of a question from my Uncle Stu, who asked me, what about kosher meat? And then he dies. I can't talk to him about it. My mother relays the question. I thought, that's a darn good question. And as I started to write the book, I get into these conversations with my mother and father about their experiences as children, about parents. And then, I have to say, in the middle of the book, my parents pass away. And so these stories that I get from them are powerful, and they're in the book because they were such vivid experiences. I begin the chapter on kosher slaughter, which is about ethics, describing, showing my mother the biopic about Temple Grandin, because Temple Grandin is quietly yet central to the developments in kosher slaughter, which makes it more ethical.
She is on the autism spectrum and serves as a consultant in agribusiness.
And you probably don't know how important she is in kosher meat, because she doesn't talk about that. She just takes care of it. What happens with kosher meat is this. There's a lot of concern by animal rights people that kosher slaughter is not humane, because under the religious rules, the animal has to be conscious at the time that it's killed. That's to make sure it's not damaged, which, of course, is an issue in the meat industry today. Temple Grandin gets involved in this debate in the 70s. She looks at what's happening in these kosher slaughter plants. She is appalled at what's going on. And she says, but if you can do this better, kosher slaughter is ethical. Kosher slaughter can be gentle to animals. And she figures out a technology on how to do it better. She persuades the Orthodox Union, it's extraordinary, that this is indeed an appropriate way. And she and the Orthodox Union go around to meatpacking plants in the 80s and the 90s, and they change the way kosher slaughter is done.
How so?
Well, the issue there is how the animal is restrained prior to the shochet cutting through its veins. And she figures out a way to restrain the animal gently and to hold it firmly so it doesn't even feel the knife. And this is the way most kosher meat is slaughtered these days, is the method that Temple Grandin devises with the Orthodox rabbis.
Can that method, though, be adopted to mainstream slaughterhouses?
It certainly could. There's only one problem with it, though. It's slow. And it's slow because the animal has to stand there until it falls unconscious. It can't be grabbed by the rear leg and pulled down a line semi-conscious, as still has happened sometimes in meatpacking plants, before it actually dies.
As a food historian, I'm sure you're familiar with Upton Sinclair's signature work, The Jungle, about the horrors of the Chicago meatpacking plants at the start of the 20th century. To what extent does that inform consumers now about the ethics of selecting kosher versus wondering what goes on in agribusiness?
Well, I think consumers always worry about their food. And not just Sinclair. You can think about some of the recent food books that have come out that talk about all the problems in it. Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, another one, Omnivore's Dilemma, Michael Pollan. Consumers always worry about food. And so with kosher food, there's something about rabbis and their belief in God, which lets people trust them and trust their judgment. When people are suspicious about food, they are reassured to see the kosher symbol on the package.